This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Presenteeism is an affliction of American culture. That's the term for showing up at work, even when you're sick and possibly infectious. But what if the person who is coughing and sneezing and pushing through a fever is your physician? A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics found that a disturbing amount of healthcare workers go to work when they are sick. Jeff Stark is an infection control officer at Texas Children's Hospital. He wrote a commentary called When the Healthcare Worker is Sick that accompanied the study when it was published. Jeff Stark, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So first, a little on the study. Where did it take place?
The study took place at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and it was a study of faculty or senior physicians and advanced care providers, over 500 of them, asking them questions whether or not they worked when they were sick, and if so, why?
Well, so what were the findings?
Well, 80% of the folks that answered said that they, in fact, had worked when they were sick with a potentially infectious illness. To be perfectly honest with you, when I talk to people, I say 80% said yes, and 20% were probably lying, because I don't think I know a physician that hasn't gone to work when he or she was ill. And the reasons were interesting. A lot of them had to do with dedication. Dedication to the patients, dedication to their colleagues, and so forth. But some of them were more disturbing. One of them was the inability to find someone else to fill in for them, and the feeling that they, in fact, were responsible for finding someone to work for them. You know, so again, the person who's sick has to go out and find the person who's going to cover. And even more disturbing to many of us is physicians now are being graded on their productivity, how many patients we're seeing, how much money we're generating. And a lot of the respondents said that they came to work because they couldn't afford to lose the productivity, which is very disturbing.
Okay, so some of those sound like procedural, workplace-based, and some sound personal. What do you think it is about the culture of healthcare workers in particular that makes this seem personal?
Well, the good side of things is I think people are really incredibly dedicated, and they're dedicated to the patients, they're dedicated to the jobs and the institutions, and this sort of overwhelming feeling of not wanting to let people down. This goes back a long, long time. When I was in training 30 years ago, I mean, people would literally be working while they were receiving IVs because they were dehydrated. You call it macho culture. Physicians who took off when they were sick were sometimes even considered slackers. You know, it's kind of similar to a football player sort of playing through an injury or playing through pain. We sort of expect ourselves to do exactly the same thing. From the institution point of view, the institutions still kind of think of doctors as individual practitioners and haven't really set up systems to allow for the fact that sometimes the physician won't be able to be there because they're sick or have something else come up.
Well, as you point out, this goes counter to the guiding principle for all healthcare workers that they first do no harm. What are the risks here?
Well, minimal colds are probably not that big a deal. In fact, by the time people are suffering real cold symptoms, probably they're not even as infectious as they were a few days earlier, although they are potentially infectious. Particularly worrisome, though, are things like the flu. You know, we know, for instance, that flu shots are not 100%. In fact, this past year, they were only 19% effective. And so there are contagious diseases physicians can have that they can pass on to other folks. If a person's in the hospital and they're fairly healthy and they're for sort of an acute problem, that's one thing. But we have an awful lot of people in hospitals now whose immune systems are not functioning well. And if they get what to you and me might be a simple cold, it can literally be deadly to them. So the risk of even simple infections can be quite great for certain patients.
Well, you teach at Baylor. You're also at Children's Hospital. You're an example of a healthcare worker I wonder if you've ever been that physician who was feeling a little bit ill but continued to press on and go to work.
Oh, of course I have. Yes, absolutely I have. In fact, when I give lectures to physicians in other groups, I have several slides. The title of the slides are Working When You're Sick. And it's kind of an acknowledgement that people are going to work when they're sick, but there are some things you can do to minimize the risk. Things as simple as good hand hygiene, since most of these infections are actually spread on the hands and not through the air, sometimes wearing masks, and then making sure you don't go see vulnerable patients. And to be honest, if I were counseling a family or if my child were in the hospital, particularly if my child were sick and vulnerable to catching infections, if someone came in the room and they were obviously ill, I would ask them to leave and say, I'm sorry, I really don't want you around my child. And I think that's a perfectly valid thing for patients and families to do.
So just, Dark, what needs to happen in order for this culture to change?
Well, I think the major thing that needs to happen is that institutions need to change, especially in children's hospitals now. In most all over the country, the physicians actually work for the hospital. And so the hospitals need to develop systems that have much more of a team approach. And we need to morph more toward, you know, it's not just my service and my patients, but it's our team's service and team's patients, and allow for this and cover for each other and have systems whereby people don't feel so responsible, not only just for being there, but also for finding whoever else can take care of their patients. So I think hospitals have some responsibility here. I think practices have some responsibility here. And, of course, so do individuals.
Well, Jeff Stark, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff Stark, he's an infection control officer at Texas Children's Hospital and professor at Baylor College of Medicine. He wrote the commentary, When the Healthcare Worker is Sick, that was published in JAMA Pediatrics. You'll find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Watching movies, making dinner, ordering a book, finding a date, all can be done online. Add a visit to the doctor to the virtual lifestyle mix. Telemedicine has been around for years, mostly to connect remote or rural patients with healthcare workers and specialists. It is now accessible to anyone with a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Abby Goodenough is a healthcare reporter for the New York Times who recently wrote about the increasing use of telemedicine for house calls. And Abby, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So why would someone consult a doctor online?
Well, convenience is the number one reason. A lot of people, you know, they kind of dread going to the doctor. They dread making an appointment, maybe being told that they can't come in for a day or two. They dread even more the idea of going to an urgent care clinic or worse, an emergency room and waiting 45 minutes or an hour or 3 hours to get the care they need. So people can sit right in their homes and use Skype or a version, something like Skype, that they're already really familiar with to do this. And it's just easy and pretty straightforward and simple.
I've seen examples of telemetry in very remote places. You know, they'd have tools for reading a heart rate or
right.
temperature. How can they do that on a regular smartphone or computer?
Well, that's getting further than down the road than we are really already. The thing that I wrote about that's really taking off in terms of direct-to-consumer telemedicine, as they call it, is the virtual urgent care, which is really just seeing doctors online for really basic things like a sore throat or a virus or a cold. I think they're working on things now that will help you do more diagnostic stuff, like take the place of a stethoscope or a blood pressure cuff or something and be able to transfer that data online from your home or your workplace or wherever, but for the most part, we're not there yet.
You mentioned the convenience of telemedicine. Who is going to benefit most from this kind of medicine?
Well, I think it's going to continue to benefit the people who telemedicine has always benefited to an extent, which is people who have trouble accessing doctors, especially if you live in a more rural or remote location. So it's going to continue to help those people, and it's also just going to help the harried. It's going to help moms who are worried about their kids in the middle of the night, since this is like a 24/7 operation a lot of the time. It's going to help busy working people who don't want to take time from work to go to see the doctor or to an urgent care clinic. It's going to help people who just want to save time in their day and people who are busy, or at least I think that's how the companies are looking at it.
Who are some of the companies who are involved?
Well, I wrote about how health and hospital systems are increasingly getting involved themselves because they see competition from not just from telemedicine companies, but from the minute clinics of the world, the retail drugstore type clinic that are also providing more convenient kind of doctor's appointment. But so some of the companies are Doctor on Demand, Teladoc, American Well. These companies, or many of them, have their own apps that you can download and go through a process to sign up and see one of their doctors directly. But increasingly, a lot of them are also working with health and hospital systems as sort of a third-party provider. So it will look like the hospital system that you're getting your doctor's appointment from online, but they're really using doctors and a technology platform of this third-party company.
How does the cost compare to a visit to urgent care or primary care, for that matter?
It's significantly cheaper than a primary care doctor appointment, which I believe is in the several hundred dollar range. Most of these urgent care visits are somewhere between $40 and $50, maybe a little more.
Are these kind of telemedicine consultations covered by insurance?
Increasingly, they are covered by insurance. You know, a lot of the big insurers are now getting into this and deciding they want to offer this as a benefit or cover it as a benefit. United Healthcare is jumping in and going to be covering it for most of their members. And that's like one of the largest insurance companies in the country, if not the largest, by the end of next year. Aetna has also really jumped into it. A lot of workplaces, like if you have an employer-sponsored health insurance plan, they will also cover it as a benefit at this point, and more jumping in. So I think it is more likely moving forward that more of us will have this as a covered benefit. But at this point, there's still a lot of us who would have to pay for it out of pocket.
And Medicare will not cover it, I understand from your article.
Medicare will not cover it for the most part. I think there's a couple of exceptions, maybe with Medicare Advantage plans, but for the most part, Medicare has not jumped in wholeheartedly to telemedicine, and particularly to direct-to-consumer type of telemedicine. There are some reports or estimates that suggest that it's just going to add to costs, that using this type of telemedicine is going to add to overall healthcare costs, not actually reduce it. And one of the questions is whether people are going to use it in addition to going to the doctor, or perhaps use it instead of not doing anything at all, in which case it certainly would increase costs, at least some. But I think there's increasingly, you know, pressure on Medicare to start experimenting more with offering this sort of thing because there is increasing demand for it and people are saying it just makes sense.
We're speaking with Abby Goodenough. She's a healthcare reporter for The New York Times. She recently wrote about accessing healthcare consultations online via Skype or FaceTime or similar kind of platforms. How do doctors seem to feel about it? I mean, it would be competition for them, I would imagine.
Right. I think for every doctor you ask, you're going to get a different opinion. I mean, certainly there's many, many doctors who are now working part-time or full-time or on contract for these companies who are totally buying into it. There's a lot of other doctors, more old-school doctors in particular, who think it's bad medicine, basically, who think it's really impossible and dangerous to try to diagnose any sort of ailment over the internet and by video. They want to lay hands on the patient. They want to look closely at the patient's eyes and ears and throat and feel the pulse, all the things that you can't do if you're staring at somebody, no matter how close, via video.
Yeah, I wonder about accuracy and malpractice in these kind of cases as well.
Right. All of these companies, for the most part, say they haven't had any malpractice cases at this point, and they say it's because partly because they're extra careful. They err on the side of caution so much, they say. They're making sure that they're not trying to diagnose or treat something that's not appropriate to be treated online. But it'll be interesting to see as this sort of visit proliferates if malpractice will become more of an issue.
Well, in many ways, this idea of you must see a doctor in order to get a prescription, and this is one way to get around that, you know, there are a couple of different sides to that. It's just part of the system. And the other is, you know, you just get a drug prescription for everything you get seen for. Does this kind of interaction with the doctor increase that probability that you're just getting an imprimatur stamp to get a prescription?
I think that's a big question, and one that doctors who are really hesitant about this type of service are batting around a lot and debating. I do know that there are certain types of prescriptions you can't get through these virtual care services, like for controlled substances. They're not going to prescribe those. There's a lot of concern that it's just a way to hand out antibiotic prescriptions and perhaps in inappropriate cases where people don't really need antibiotics. Although there was an interesting study recently that suggested that these virtual appointments don't dispense antibiotics at any higher rate than in person. But I, to get back to your basic question, I think that you do have to kind of give your medical history and go through a number of questions. And many of these doctors, from what I've seen, do ask some pretty thorough questions and take their time trying to figure out what's wrong with you. So I think that the good providers doing this and the careful and cautious providers are not just handing out prescriptions left and right.
Clearly, our adaptation of smartphone apps and conveniences online has been rapid. Do you think there's a real game changer for healthcare system in the U.S. in the coming years?
I mean, if you look at how much of a game changer this kind of technology has been for so many other facets of our life, for shopping and for, you know, making travel arrangements and all of the things that we now totally are accustomed to and want to do online, you would think that it could definitely be a big game changer for medicine. I think, of course, there are natural limitations and there are some really obvious things that you do in medicine that you're just not going to be able to do via video. But I do think in terms of people seeking convenience and wanting easier access to healthcare, this could be an interesting solution and potentially a game changer. As a harried person myself, I can certainly see the appeal.
Well, Abby Goodenough, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Abby Goodenough, she's a reporter for the New York Times, recently wrote the article Modern Doctors, House Calls, Skype Chat, and Fast Diagnosis. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We often think of music as a passion or an entertainment or an art form. But for people with certain language or cognitive difficulties, it can also be a tool for rewiring the brain, helping treat conditions from Parkinson's to traumatic brain injuries and many others. In this story, Rebecca Shear takes us to Norfolk, Virginia, where she found one of the only facilities in the country dedicated to uniting music and medicine.
For people who've suffered a stroke, speech can be incredibly difficult. As music therapist Tracy Bowdish explains,
they know exactly what they want to say, but they're not able to find the words to say it.
So imagine you have a word on the tip of your tongue and you can't get it out.
And imagine all of your words are that way.
But with a practice known as neurologic music therapy, before long you could find those words by singing them.
Because that stroke is in a very specific area of the brain, and because we use more of our brains when we sing than we do when we speak, often those people still retain the ability to sing.
Tracy Bowdish works at the Sentara Music and Medicine Center in Norfolk, Virginia, one of the few such centers in the country. To get patients talking again, she starts with helpful everyday phrases.
Like, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I need to get up.
And uses music to make them stick. So let's say she's teaching a patient that first phrase.
I'm hungry.
She starts by making up a simple melody to go along with the words.
I'm hungry, I'm hungry.
She then hums that melody for her patient while tapping his hand to provide extra rhythmic cues. Once the patient starts humming along, Tracy adds in the words.
I'm hungry, I'm hungry.
And once the patient starts singing those words, Tracy starts fading the music out.
I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry.
Next comes the big test, whether the patient can find meaning in the phrase and use it in context. So when prompted with a question like,
what would you say if you wanted something to eat?
Ideally, he would reply,
I'm hungry.
Though, at a recent session with 70-year-old Jim Bob Rodriguez, who suffered a stroke and has been working with Tracy Bowdish about a year now,
what would you say if your stomach was growling?
Tracy gets an unexpected reply.
I want to eat.
I want to eat, he says, beaming from his wheelchair. Tracy couldn't be more thrilled.
That is fabulous.
Huh?
You know why that's so fabulous?
Why?
Because we practiced I'm hungry. And you said I want to eat. Well, you know what that means? That means you're using your own words and not my words. And that makes my day.
Someone else whose day it makes is Jim Bob's wife of 40-plus years, Sandy. Jim Bob can't use the right side of his body, and he's hard of hearing, but Sandy says her husband has come a long way.
When we brought him home from the rehab, nursing home, he was on a feeding tube. He couldn't do anything for himself.
Sandy had heard how Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords used music therapy to regain speech after being shot in the head. So Sandy was hopeful when she heard about Tracy Bowdish at Sentara. 1 year later, not only is Jim Bob incorporating all the phrases he's learned in his sessions.
He comes up with things like, ooh, you feel sweaty or you feel hot or, you know, and it always takes us aback because we're not expecting it.
Though there is one phrase Sandy has come to expect and appreciate more than words can say.
Every night he tells me he loves me and he does it very meaningfully. So that's always very special to know that.
Dr. Kamal Shamali founded the Sentara Music and Medicine Center in 2010. The neurologist says because music is so commonplace in our world.
You know, music is ubiquitous. It's everywhere.
It doesn't always get its due as a viable tool for helping people like Jim Bob Rodriguez. Instead, it's often overlooked in favor of other, more well-known therapies.
We have examples, especially those stroke patients with a rehabilitation of language, where we were able to bring back language after 4 weeks, let's say, of music therapy, when 20 weeks of speech therapy did not bring back the language.
And yet, most insurance companies still don't reimburse music therapy. So many hospitals have yet to implement it.
Why would physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy be reimbursed without any problems, and music therapy, which is sometimes more effective, not be reimbursed? You know, doesn't make sense.
That's why the center charges just $40 for each session of neurologic music therapy. Sentara, which runs a network of nonprofit hospitals in the region, incurs the remainder of the cost, which makes it easier for patients like Jim Bob Rodriguez
like to
come in on a regular basis.
Well,
he's had about 40 sessions with Tracy Bowdish now, and in honor of his upcoming anniversary with Sandy on August 1st.
This one's a hard one. I want to try it, though.
Today, they're working on a new phrase. First, Tracy hums it. Then they hum it together. And once Jim Bob can hum it by himself.
Very good.
It's time for the words.
Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary.
After Jim Bob sings the phrase on his own,
happy anniversary.
Tracy fades out the music.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
That was very, very good.
The next step is to add in a very special phrase Jim Bob has already learned.
I love you, Sandy. Happy anniversary. Very good. We're going to work our way up to that.
Yeah.
I'm Rebecca Shear.
For decades, the popular image of a surgeon was of a brusque, singularly focused professional, long on expertise and short on bedside manner. Today, even the most technically gifted surgeons are also expected to exhibit some emotional awareness and the ability to communicate well with patients. Wen Shen is a surgeon specializing in endocrinology at UC San Francisco's Medical Center. He argues that the quest to create a kinder surgeon, though admirable, may not be very good for our health. We spoke to him when his article appeared in Pacific Standard magazine. Well, first, tell us a little bit about the culture of surgeons that you observed when you were a resident, which some might consider to be kind of the good old days.
Yes, I started my training in 1999, and at that time, I think, at least my perception was, many of the old stereotypes about surgeons still definitely held true. surgeons were fearless, confident, bordering, in fact, often exhibiting arrogant behavior, always sure of their decisions. And there was a definite high level of machismo and kind of I can take care of this bad acidness that pervaded all levels of my surgical training program. And I aspired to be that kind of fighter pilot, that kind of take charge and, you know, very, very aggressive type person. And it was very difficult to reconcile some of my own insecurities and doubts and feelings about, you know, whether or not I was causing harm in my patients with this image, this heroic image that I wanted to emulate.
So I guess that bravado probably wouldn't go over very well inside of the hospital either. I mean, if you have so many fighter pilots on the same floor, how does everybody get along?
Well, I mean, I can say, I mean, the paradox that I talk about in the article and that I think is still probably quite present is that surgeons are celebrated for their abilities, in fact, a very necessary and vital part of the medical community and society at large. But at the same time, they're probably, at least in reputation, among the most reviled and even feared members of the hospital staff.
You tell stories of your fellow residents and you thinking nothing of yelling at nurses, bullying the internal medicine and ER docs, even throwing instruments around. So what has changed since you were a resident?
Well, it's interesting. It hasn't even been that long, but even in that time, within the past decade or two, there's been a remarkable shift. And I would say definitely overwhelmingly for the positive at putting a damper on some of that behavior. And the idea, I think, stemmed really from this concept of multidisciplinary care in medicine and the importance of teamwork and effective communication and collaboration. And overall, those kinds of behaviors that, you know, they weren't routine, like happening every single day, but it was not unheard of to see senior surgeons throwing instruments or people yelling or bullying. And the interesting thing is that all this was tailored towards, you know, ostensibly taking care of the patient, right? The patient's number one. But then all these kind of negative behaviors stemmed out of that, and doing right for your patient meant, you know, ticking off and even bullying other people. And there's definitely been a damper put on that, and I think it's overall created much more positive working environments in the operating room and on the wards. And definitely some of that behavior is absolutely grounds for either at least a trip to the chair's office and sometimes even suspension if it goes that far.
Mm-hmm. So is there this belief that if you're a nice surgeon, you're not good at your job?
Well, I don't think so. And that's the thing that is, to me, the most kind of interesting, the crux problem that I try to investigate or explore in this article is I don't think they are mutually exclusive, but I think it is very difficult to reconcile some of the personality traits that we inculcate into trainees and young surgeons with this idea of being kind and compassionate and gentle. I think you have to very much toggle between extremes of your emotional state, where in the operating room or when dealing with a difficult situation, you have to be a cold-blooded killer in many ways. You have to be focused. You have to be perfectionist. You have to be single-minded. And then immediately ratchet over and be kind and gentle and calm and understanding. All those things, it's very difficult to go between those emotional states. And that's what I wanted to highlight, is that we ask surgeons to be good at both.
It's so interesting to use that term, the cold-blooded killer. You know, when the patient is number one, saving the life is number one. And of course, this is all coming from the patient's perspective, right? That we interact with the personality rather than seeing their surgical skill in the operating room. And you illustrate this in a story in your piece, comparing Dr. Hodad and the raptor. Can you illuminate that story for us?
Yeah, I took that from my friend Marty Makary, who's a surgeon at Johns Hopkins, who wrote a book published 2 years ago called Unaccountable, about transparency in healthcare. And he uses this story from his residency as an illustration of the different kinds of docs that are out there. And he talks about a Dr. Hodad, who was a very kindly, well-liked surgeon who all the patients just loved because he had outstanding bedside manner and was very communicative and took time and all these very positive qualities. But in the operating room, he had terrible skills, and his patients actually did very badly. And HODAD stood for Hands of Death and Destruction.
Ooh.
And the residents and the staff all knew that he had bad outcomes and couldn't operate, but because the patients loved him so much, he was extraordinarily popular and successful. On the other hand, he talks about the Raptor, who was another surgeon on staff, who was the, I guess, embodiment of the negative stereotypes of surgeons. Cold, abrasive, and definitely not popular amongst patients and staff, but had outstanding technical skills and outcomes, and his patients did wonderfully. And he uses that as an example to look at how transparency in healthcare will allow for us to better understand what's behind the demeanor, and you know that poor surgeons like Dr. Hodad would not be allowed to continue because their outcomes would become public. But what I wanted to look at was what's going on with the Raptor, because the emphasis now on customer satisfaction as a provider metric, something that insurance companies are using to determine reimbursement and such, the behaviors of someone like the Raptor are not going to be tolerated. And even though the outcomes are good, if the external appearance or the interaction is not good, then the Raptor is in danger of also suffering the same fate as the HODAD.
To quote Stephen Sondheim, nice is different than good. And that's part of the question being asked by my guest, Wen Chen. He's a surgeon and endocrinologist and author of an article for Pacific Standard's Medical Issue called Bloody Nice: Is the Quest to Build a Kinder, Gentler Surgeon Misguided? Well, Wen Chen, you're at a teaching hospital and cite a 2013 study showing that surgical professionals estimate that fewer than half of new residents are able to perform routine procedures independently, and then more than a quarter of the graduating residents feel they need more training. Now, is it possible that these numbers are not new, but surgeons are simply more willing to acknowledge doubt nowadays?
Yes, I think that's actually probably a big part of it. A lot of this is perception, and you can see that those were survey studies, and one study was surveying the program directors, so the kind of supervising surgeons, and their perception was that the trainees were not as capable as they have been in the past. On the flip side, the survey of graduating residents also asked them, how do you feel? And a lot of them did say that they didn't feel confident in their abilities enough to go out and practice independently. And I think, you know, a lot of this is perception, but I think also, at least on the surgical trainee side, it's this willingness to admit uncertainty or doubt, which you could argue is a good thing. You want your young surgeon to know his or her limits and where they need to improve. But at the same time, now we have to create a system that gives them that confidence and that self-assurance that they can ultimately go out and do their job.
So how do you suggest patients approach a hospital stay? If someone's looking for an excellent surgeon, should they go with the person they most dislike?
No, definitely not. I mean, I think at the core, still, you have to have trust in the surgeon. That does not necessarily mean you have to like him or her. The problem is, patients and customers don't have access to good information. A lot of it is usually very, very superficial in many ways. And really, until we have a system where the outcomes, the surgeon's outcomes are available and understood, that we can make more informed decisions. Right now, the best way you can do it is really kind of word of mouth. You can ask the hospital staff who they would go to. A lot of people get recommended by friends or someone who's gone through a similar thing, and having a way that's more objective and of measuring surgeons is going to be, I think, the way of the future, and it's already happening.
Well, we find word of mouth is the best way to communicate a lot.
Yes, that's the name of the show, I forgot.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Virginia.
And that was from an earlier conversation with Wen Chen. He's a surgeon specializing in endocrinology at the UCSF Medical Center. You'll find a link to read his article for Pacific Standard at wordofmouthradio.org. While emotional connection may not be a priority for every surgeon, any worthwhile practitioner strives for their patients to survive and to heal. So when Howell Graham underwent a risky double lung transplant in 1990, proving that his doctors had done the right thing was a part of his goal in recovery. Howell has cystic fibrosis, a genetic disease that affects the lungs. He and his mother, Nan, remembered the days after that surgery for StoryCorps.
I remember waking up from the surgery, being on the vent, and seeing this absolutely beautiful brunette nurse. She held my hand her entire shift, and, you know, I was kind of in and out of consciousness. And I guess the following shift, a male nurse came in, this big burly dude, and I was not happy at all. Couldn't talk because I was on the ventilator, but I just was writing notes like, get him the heck out of here, and I don't want this guy, get me the girl back. And
Lots of cursing.
And my dad was tearing up the notes because he was scared the male nurse would find the notes and kill me. So he spent his time intercepting my hate notes.
Which is kind of understandable. When did you get out of the hospital?
It was a month later.
And when you got home, things were going well and you...
Well, things were going fantastic. And I had been out in my dad's little 17-foot boat thinking I knew what I was doing. And I ended up jumping out of the boat. And the boat got away from me, and it's too far to swim, and I really thought I was going to drown.
6 months out of a double lung
transplant. 6 months out of a double lung transplant, and the first thing that popped in my mind was Dr. Egan, who's kind of a little fireball, how mad he was going to be that he had given me this transplant, and I blew it just being stupid.
He said he would have killed me, and I said he would have had to get in line. Your father and I would have been the first in line to kill you for this. We worked 28 years. He worked 12 hours.
Yeah.
And so...
21 years later almost, that these are my lungs, and it's pretty amazing to have made it that far out. I've just been a lucky person.
Life is good.
Life is good.
And that was Howell Graham and his mother, Nan, at StoryCorps in Wilmington, North Carolina. Today, Howell is one of the longest surviving recipients of a double lung transplant. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jason DeSilva was one of those filmmakers other young directors wanted to be. Talented, handsome, imaginative, and at 25, well-regarded enough to fund travel around the world to make documentary films. Well, that was then.
You can take that scooter.
I just started using a cane. And they're already talking about wheelchairs.
And that is Jason DeSilva, a little more than a year after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. No amount of will or exercise or attempted cures could stave off the decline of his body. His sharp, creative mind, however, kept working and kept filming. The result is When I Walk. It's a documentary film that screened at Sundance and made its national premiere on PBS last year. PBS is having an encore broadcast of When I Walk on August 10th. We spoke to Jason DeSilva just before its broadcast premiere. Now, you've been diagnosed with MS, but hadn't really seen it manifest until vacation in St. Martin, and this is 2006. We see it on film. Your legs just give way on the beach, and you struggle to get up. Did you ever question that you turned this whole experience into a film?
Not at the time. You know, so, like, at first, it was really just to document. I was out there on that beach, actually, so that whole scene... I was just documenting the planes flying overhead. You know, it's interesting that there's a beach and all of a sudden there's an airport that's really close to it. But then all of a sudden my brother took the camera and turned it on me just to film myself not being able to get up again. And from there what became was When I Walk.
Jason, you're so unsparing the way that you keep the camera trained on yourself as you lose mobility, you lose motor skills. You know, we see you waking up in the morning and struggling to get up and put your clothing on, several falls, things that you could edit out, obviously, to make this a different kind of film. So is that your instinct? I mean, do you think this is how I would treat other documentary subjects? Why not me? I'm interested in those decisions.
I had a lot of people to help me just kind of review the footage and look over what I did. I thought that beach scene was kind of cool, so that's why I made it to the early edits. But a lot of the other stuff where I was, you know, I just was falling with my walker and just scenes like that in general, where I couldn't get up out of bed myself. Those I wanted to keep out. But a lot of people that I was working with, they were like, why don't you keep that scene in there? You know, it's like something profound. It took about 2 years of filming till I understood that things like that were really important to keep in for a film like this. And just to be honest to the viewer and, just to myself as well.
Well, you were funded to make a film in India, which you found that it was just too difficult to do, and you turned this trip into an exploration of cures. What are some of the various cures that you tried?
Yeah, that's a good question. So on that trip, the things that I was looking into were really alternative treatments. So as you said, there's no cure for my kind of MS. So it really is, we're left to the wide world of alternative treatments. So in India, I was looking into transformational psychology and meditation as well. So that was one thing I did. I looked into yoga, and I still look into yoga. And I don't think that these things are not beneficial. I think they're really important. And the third thing I was looking into was Ayurvedic medicine as well. So, I just have people put a lot of different oils on me and ended up getting really messy. But it worked out well.
Well, nothing cured you, so to speak, and you later did try this vascular treatment that you found out about on the internet. Was there a moment for you, Jason, when you just accepted, okay, this is happening, this is where I am, this is how it's going to be?
You know, that's a good question. So even to this day, I'm still surprised by it. Every morning when I wake up and when I can't get out of bed without somebody else's help, things like that, I'm still surprised by it. Or even like going day to day and having to drive around in my power chair, it surprises me. But there's a certain level of acceptance that came. It was probably, it wasn't until I put the film out there and it premiered at Sundance that I felt like, you know, it's okay. Like, what I'm going through is really hard, but at least it's going to help other people as well.
Well, you mentioned that you got help from other people. Alice, who you were dating, became your wife. But some of that fighting spirit must come from your mother, Marianne D'Souza. Now, here she is in the film giving you a pretty good talking to when you say that you don't think that you can finish your film.
Well, you constantly talk about being sick all the time anyway. You know? It's constant. You're always whining and sighing. You only have one life, and I know I miss practicality, but we don't know how long we have to live. We could be dead tomorrow. Quit your film right now. How does it feel? Just quit. Yeah, seriously. Do you feel like a sense of relief?
I'm just saying that it's really tough to make the film. I'm not going to quit the film, but it's really tough making the film.
Things are tough in life. Get real.
It's true.
You mollycoddled North American kid.
That's a clip from the film When I Walk. I'm speaking with one of the film's directors and producers, Jason DeSilva, also the subject of the film. That was your mother there, Jason, you know, being pretty strident and whatever the opposite of whiny is. But you're kind of smirking. How did that sit with you? Her saying like, oh, you think you have it bad, people have it worse.
Yeah, well, for me, that scene was, I was really happy to catch that on camera. Because she's like that every day, you know, it doesn't. But my smirk is, it's just me being pleased with the fact that I got that on camera for the rest of the world to see. This is what I have to deal with every day for the for all my life, until I'm old. I have to deal with my mom saying things like that.
Well, you take her advice and you attend an MS support group, which is pretty fortunate because you meet Alice Cook, who you begin seeing. We see that in the film. You go to Hawaii together. There's this wonderful scene of you riding scooters down the ramp at the Guggenheim. But as you guys get more serious, you ask her some very frank questions about your future. You know, what happens when I can't eat my food? Will you be the person who feeds me? Do you think you're able to ask those questions or maybe emboldened because you were making a film?
Yeah, I do, actually. I would definitely be more graceful and just kind of easier about it than I was when I was confronting her with the camera. You know, like, I wouldn't have been like, so are you going to be the person that feeds me if I didn't have a camera right in front of her and asking her those questions?
Well, you want to get married, you two want to have a family, which you can do physically, but we overhear these crucial conversations about your intimacy, and here's a clip from the film about longevity.
How do you think about your, like, 40s and your 50s? Are you scared of her?
Scared of my 40s and 50s? No, it just... I'm not gonna live past 50, which sucks, but I'm gonna, like, do everything I can before that. I think I'm just, like, kind of pissed off that, like, that this happened. And that the world's not really, like, accommodating.
That's a clip from the film When I Walk. I'm speaking to the film's director, producer, and subject, Jason De Silva. And Jason, as your bodily functions wane, you become more and more dependent on Alice, who is just indefatigable, except in some moments when she is talking to the camera herself, you know, admitting fear, admitting that she feels trapped at times, and showing a great deal of vulnerability. Had you seen those before you were editing the film? I mean, were you present for those moments?
No, actually. No, I wasn't. So a lot of the stuff she gave to me afterwards just as footage, you know, so I didn't actually... I mean, I did see the fact... I did know the fact that she and that's why we got married, and I wanted her in my life. I didn't know that she had those aspects in her and could talk about those things, but I didn't know that she could on the camera, and so that was a big thing. So, looking at the footage afterwards and her revealing what she was thinking, those were things that even surprised me.
There's so much joy in this film, and I don't want to diminish that at all. A lot of creativity, a lot of courage and doing good. In fact, you and Alice helped create this app for helping people find handicapped accessible places in New York City. And you mentioned this kind of sense of acceptance when you watched the film at Sundance. Watching it now, where do you think you'll go? What is your trajectory?
Oh, well, I know. I'm pretty clear about, like, what I'm doing next and, yeah, where to go from here. I mean, obviously, it took... After you work on a film like When I Walk, which is a 5-7 film that's a personal film, I think I went under a tight existential crisis as a creative person where I had to question about what is the next thing that I want to do with myself? Is it really worth it to keep going as a filmmaker? And then I turned around and decided, so after about a year, that there really is just a lot more of this story that needs to be told, especially about, like, what the next level of disability is like for me, and even what issues like accessibility and even fatherhood now, like, what do those things, like, what are those things like? I think that those are new things just for me to explore, but for people to hear about as well.
And that was my earlier conversation with the filmmaker Jason De Silva. His film, When I Walk, made its national debut on PBS in 2014, and an encore broadcast is coming up on August 10th. You'll find more information and local listings at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, thank you for spending some time with us on a precious summer weekend. Even if you can't listen to Word of Mouth during the week, you can catch the show in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend or post segments on Facebook or Twitter. Help us put New Hampshire and Word of Mouth on the map. As you know, the most interesting stuff travels by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.